Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Summer is here and kids should be having a blast, but there are hundreds of kids involved with the Boys and Girls Village foster and therapeutic foster care programs who are looking for a caring person or family to help them feel at home again. So stay tuned and learn more and see if you can get involved. Then we're going to talk data, who uses it, why, and how data can be accessed and applied to improve your academic project, nonprofit, community agency, journalism initiative, and so much more. We're going to welcome and discuss how you can be part of the Connecticut Data Collaborative. And if you're a veteran or someone who cares about a vet that may have been dealt out of support services because of a non-qualifying discharge, we're going to introduce you to the New Haven-based National Veterans Council for Legal Redress. See if they can help. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. As we close out Pride Month, the hub at RYASAP, the Behavioral Health Action Organization of Southwestern Connecticut, reminds us that we can support individuals of any age or persuasion by taking an active interest in LGBTQ issues, by recognizing, acknowledging, and addressing our own biases, by being vocal in our support, and being a good ally by taking care of ourselves. And remember, outing is an act that takes away the freedom, autonomy, and safety of another individual's and should be avoided. For support groups and mental health services geared towards LGBTQ communities, just visit thehubct.org/LGBTQIA-resources. Well, we're opening up the program with our neighbors, Boys and Girls Village over here on Wheeler's Farms Road, just off the parkway, has been an organization that has been near and dear to the award-winning For the People, going back almost the entire 29-plus years that I've been doing the show. And as I was sharing with our guest here this morning, Janet McCarty, who's the director of the Therapeutic Foster Care Program for Boys and Girls Village, there were no girls when we first started learning about this organization. It was just Boys Village, and we were driving by that sign on the parkway before we went over the Sikorsky Bridge or coming back off of it. And now here we are, Boys and Girls Village for the 21st century, an exceedingly beautiful, thriving, full-service campus full of activities. But the reason we've got Janet on the program today is that they reached out to us during May, which was Foster Care Month, about talking about the need and the waiting list and how badly we really need all you folks out there in Connecticut who may be able to provide a love and a home and services to this waiting list of kids who are just looking for a place that they can call home and feel good about. So we're going to call on you all here as we head into the summer to think about becoming a foster parent or a therapeutic foster parent. Boys and Girls Village Permanency Planning Service provides a pathway for children to find permanent homes and keep families together with that statewide therapeutic foster and kinship care program, as well as family preservation and reunification programs to keep families and children together. So first of all, thank you so much for coming on, Janet. We're way past May, but the need is as great as ever and pretty much remains constant, or maybe even kind of fluctuates upward, you know, here as we're coming out of the pandemic. Last time we had you guys on the show, we were talking to your relatively new executive director way back in January 2020 when things related to something called COVID-19 were still a little bit cloudy, but here we are coming out of it in 2021. How have you and your team and the many foster care and therapeutic foster care parents handled the past year and a half?
So So it was difficult for sure, but I will say our foster parents and our kids really rose to the occasion. On our end, we had to switch our typical face-to-face visits to virtual, while still providing that same level of support that we're able to provide in person. And again, so much of that was our foster parents, who are obviously worried about themselves, their families, their health, and our kids. So them being able to balance all those worries without having us there in person and being able to utilize phone support, virtual support, actually worked quite well. And we found that our kids and our parents were able to manage the challenges and the transitions, again, with that support, phone calls, video calls. Now that we're in June and at the other end of it, we've started doing our in-person visits again. So it's been really nice for our workers here and our foster parents and kids to reconnect in person, to start doing some outdoor activities because the weather's been so nice.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine one of the biggest challenges that, you and Boys and Girls Village have is that you know that there are thousands of people out there in Connecticut, and especially here in the Southern Connecticut area, who could be and successfully serve as a foster parent or a therapeutic foster parent. And almost each and every one of them, if you ask them, would turn around and say, I don't have what it takes to be a foster parent. So why don't you set them straight?
And I think while maybe not everybody is ready to take on being a foster parent, a full-time foster parent, there's lots of other ways you could help too. We always need respite foster parents that just provide short-term care and kind of help our full-time foster parents when a break is needed for travel or an emergency or any other purpose. And in terms of becoming a full-time foster parent, the best way to start is to just reach out and get some information. We have our initial phone screening, and then there's an interview. You're always kind of getting information about the program through those steps. And then our training is 13 weeks long, so there's lots of information that our foster parents are able to get. And at the end of those 13 weeks, we kind of collaboratively make that decision. Are you feeling like this is the right time? And for some people, it is, and they move forward. For others, it's at least opened their eyes, and they're able to support in other ways. What's also nice, and I don't know if a lot of people know this, but there's something called kinship or special study foster care as well. And that means, say you're a teacher at a school and you know one of your students is in foster care and it comes to your attention that they're going to be in need of a foster home. You, because you have a connection to that child, can reach out to DCF, the Department of Children and Families, and let them know that you might be able to be a resource or a support for that child too.
Well, I know that because I've attended a number of meetings and events where foster parents and adoptive parents are standing up and talking about their experiences. I can't tell you how many times I have heard these miraculous individuals stand up there and the first thing they say is, I never thought I could do this. And, you know, I never just sat down with myself and said, self, you know, today's the day I'm going to take the necessary steps to be a foster parent. So let's talk a little bit more about what those responsibilities are by first defining what's the difference between a foster parent and a therapeutic foster parent.
Sure. So our therapeutic foster parents are prepared and trained to parent children who may have a more significant history of abuse or neglect. They may struggle more in certain areas, their education. They may struggle more with mental health or behavioral challenges. So our foster parents are specifically trained to manage those behaviors and any of those challenges that may occur. With therapeutic foster care, you have a licensed clinician through Boys and Girls Village who's going to meet with you every week, who's also going to provide 24/7 support through our on-call, our emergency on-call system. We have continuing education credits for our foster parents, similar to, you know, any licensed profession, where you're able to learn more about certain issues around foster care. We have some based on specific behaviors if a foster parent is struggling, things that will help them, you know, either view from a different perspective or give them more tools to continue providing that level of care.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the non-therapeutic nature of foster parent care?
So for DCF level foster care, those kids, again, come from backgrounds of trauma and abuse, but the significant level of the behaviors or the mental health challenges is less than what you would see with a therapeutic child.
Very good. So in terms of the next step, I mean, we certainly have heard countless success stories about individuals who met as a foster child and foster parents who were adopted by those foster parents. But that is certainly neither an expectation nor a demand for anyone who comes to the table. So, you know, to assuage the background concerns of anyone who think that, you know, foster parenting is de facto a pathway toward adoption. That is not the case, although it happens and it is often extremely wonderful and successful.
Absolutely. It does happen sometimes. The permanency goal for all of our kids starts out as reunification, and more than a third of our kids in therapeutic foster care end up being reunited with their families or, like you said, adopted into another permanent home. But that is in no way the expectation that a foster parent has to become an adoptive parent. We have a nice pool of families who foster. They enjoy being able to make those connections with the child in the family and even maintain those connections when a kid goes back home, but they are not feeling like they're required to be that adoptive resource. And we have some families that do choose to adopt. And there's a spectrum kind of in between. You can start out saying, I am not going to adopt. Something happens, you change your mind, and that's great.
So in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Janet, think back over the, you know, the past few years and describe to us, you know, one of your favorite success stories or one of your favorite experiences that you may have had. Certainly not naming names or getting into the weeds with details that would identify the case. But, you know, what makes you feel good when you think back about some of the foster parents who you've helped put together with a child through Boys and Girls Village?
Sure. So we've had multiple success stories, but I think of one in particular because I actually just connected with this foster parent recently. We had two boys, two siblings, who were in a previous foster home. They weren't doing well there. They ended up moving to another foster home, and this family ended up adopting them. Both boys are now college-aged. They are going on to, you know, college and moving on, deciding what they want to do in the workforce and in life. And they still maintain a connection with their biological family, living with their adoptive family. And it's just a nice example of how we kind of like our foster and biological families in an ideal situation to have this blended kind of mixed family relationship, right? Where everybody can support one another, even though family members might not live together, if that makes sense.
Sure. And I guess it's also critical to reinforce that it does not require a conventional nuclear family as we might think of it. A lot of single individuals are extremely successful foster parents, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And if you have, you know, love for children and want to help children, it never hurts to seek out more information.
And all that is available just by going to bgvillage.org. And under the program tag, you can pull it down and go to the permanency planning page and begin to explore some of the details and criteria. And then maybe send the note or make the call and get involved and reach out. You can't learn whether or not it's the right thing for you until you at least make the initial inquiry. And I know that Janet Morcaldi, who's the Therapeutic Foster Care Manager for Boys and Girls Village, and her team are ready and willing to provide you with the answers that you need. Boys and Girls Village Permanency Planning Services provide that pathway for children to both find permanent homes and to keep families together through their statewide therapeutic foster and kinship care program, allowing children to live in permanent homes, as well as the family preservation and reunification program that we heard about that keep families and children together. Janet, thank you so much for your time this morning, and I wish you and your team luck. We hope that this program has inspired a few people to make the call and become foster parents on behalf of Boys and Girls Village. So have a great holiday weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, I'm so pleased to return to the subject of data. We have done a couple of segments on it over the years, and I was prompted to reintroduce the subject and get acquainted with an organization that has formed here in Connecticut that wants to basically help anyone who's out there learn more about how to access data, perhaps how to manipulate it, to basically use information that's out there in the huge resource of the internet to be able to benefit themselves or their families, groups that they work with, organizations, their workplace, or just their general lives. And I hope my guest, Sarah Isley Durley, who's the assistant director of the Connecticut Data Collaborative, is in line with that. How did I do, Sarah?
You did great. Yeah.
So, you know, I am not a data geek, but it's great to know that by the end of this interview, I'm going to have a lot more understanding, as well as our listeners, about what the collaborative is all about and how they can come to the collaborative to learn more. So with that being said, according to the website at ctdata.com, your organization offers a continuum of services to empower organizations to collect, analyze, and interpret, visualize, and use data and public data to make informed decisions. So beyond the boilerplate, let's hear it from you. What's in it for anybody who comes to CT Data?
Sure. Well, thanks for the introduction. You did a great job explaining an overview of what we do. I suppose, you know, I could start by saying we really believe that data skills are civic skills that every single person who participates in our society, who resides in Connecticut, needs to have a basic understanding of data, because we're asked to understand data, whether we're watching a news story or whether we're asked to vote. And so we have the Connecticut Data Academy, which is a low-cost series of workshops where anybody can come to learn about data. And even, you know, if you don't really work with data in your professional life, but you just find you want to be better informed when you go to the voting booth, we have a basics of data literacy course that helps people understand just the basics of how data comes to be, how we engage with it, and things we should be thinking about when we are faced with data on a regular basis. So that's part of it. We want people to be able to ethically and responsibly use data, but we also provide a lot of different resources on our website. We have public data, which can be from the Census Bureau or from state agencies, that we provide in a usable format that anybody can use, whether you're new to data or advanced. And we also have a variety of data projects that we seek to make user-friendly as well. And then finally, we do provide kind of consulting services. We offer a service called Data Strategic Planning. So we can actually come in and help organizations, institutions, agencies make decisions about their data that maybe they don't feel able to do.
All right. Well, I know you guys just a couple of weeks ago had a session to focus on demographic data collection as part of the Equity in Data Community of Practice. And I'm just wondering what the community of practice actually is, and why is the Equity in Data Community of Practice so important?
Sure. So on its, you know, on the basic level, a community of practice is just a group that it can be formal or informal, a group of people who come together wanting to learn, wanting to improve something, but sharing knowledge. So nobody comes as the expert, but you come as learners and as sharers of your own learning. So June of last year, we started about a year ago. We actually gathered to talk about equity and ethics and data, particularly as it related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
I don't not sure how many people remember, but at the very beginning of the pandemic, there was no data available on the cases or deaths related to COVID by race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So at the time, that data were not available. So we actually came together to talk about some examples of how data people had found ways to gather this data to show there's a need for testing in places where there are higher numbers of cases and deaths because of the disparate impact of this, of this virus on communities of color and communities with lower income. So we started there, and we kind of liked meeting together and liked talking together. So we kind of grew organically. We've talked about a number of subjects since the beginning, since a year ago. But this past month, we actually did have kind of our biggest event so far, where we talked about diversity, equity, and inclusion in data collection. Now, if you are someone who maybe is like me, I am white, and I've never had any challenge filling out race and ethnicity questions in surveys or in forms. Mm-hmm. But not everybody has the same experience that I have. And so we wanted to bring this this topic forward because we know people in our group have talked about feeling invisible in data. And Connecticut Data Collaborative has had the chance to work with the Sudanese American House of Connecticut. And we helped them analyze and talk about a survey that they conducted related to the pandemic. And some of the folks said, this is the first time we've ever seen our community in data. It's a really important topic if we really want to support all of the people in the state of Connecticut to live up to their human potential. We actually have to be able to understand the different groups. And the way we typically collect demographic data doesn't really allow us to do that.
So that being said, you gave us an example of who could participate, but let's just back it up a step and just talk for a couple of minutes about how this all got started. Is this a an academic based group? Is this a nonprofit that came together on its own?
Sure. So we are. Basically, Connecticut Data Collaborative supports this group, the Equity and Data Community of Practice. We are providing the backbone support, the logistics and administration, but we actually, there's a group of people, volunteers from this group who kind of rose to the surface. They attended all of the sessions, and so we actually meet every month or every other month to talk about what we want to do for the following session. So there's a planning group that meets, and this group is representative. There's, someone from a state agency, someone from a Connecticut-based nonprofit, and then someone from a Connecticut-based nonprofit that is also a national organization. So in this leadership group, we have racial, ethnic diversity, gender diversity, and also diversity of, context where people are coming from. It's definitely not an academic exercise. We are really, the folks in the group are primarily, the people who tend to sign up, I should say, are primarily people who work with data on a semi-regular or very regular basis. Data may be all of their work or some part of their work, who really just want to ensure that when they are working with data, when they're collecting data, when they're communicating data, that it really is respectful of the people who are represented in the data and that they're aware of their own biases that they bring to the data practice. So it's open to anybody from any kind of institutional background.
And you said it's been about a year since this all started?
Yeah, we began meeting started meeting in June 2020.
So as you kick that snowball off the top of the mountain, how has this grown? Are you getting the word out there, and are you satisfied or even excited about the level of participation, both in quantity and quality?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely, so, it, you know, just as far as numbers, which is obviously not the same as quality necessarily, we started off, we had about 12 people who came to the first session, maybe it was 20. And we've had, you know, each month we've had in the range of between 20 and 30 people for kind of our regular sessions where we get together and we talk about a topic. We get into breakout groups and we have discussions. When we have had guests, this recent one from the Schusterman Foundation is a recent guest. We had the Urban Institute come for one of the sessions, and then we had some local partners come and present at a session as well. And, you know, for this past one, we had 125 people sign up for this event. And, you know, I was surprised, you know, at the number, but it certainly just highlighted the fact that this is a really important topic that people are interested in diving into and talking about.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break, Sarah. Stick with us. And folks, we know it's a kind of a complex subject for early on a Sunday morning if you're listening to us live. And, you know, if you're kind of just waking up and this is all sounding like a little too much, maybe you want to come back and hit our podcast, especially if you are or know somebody who works in the public sector, the private sector, for nonprofits, and they are, you know, involved with or need to better utilize data. The Connecticut Data Collaborative is leading, convening, and facilitating statewide conferences, forums, open data calls. They're bringing data users together to advance a common agenda around data development, access, standards, and use. Sarah Isley-Durley is their assistant director, and we're going to be back to talk with her. Stick with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Read to Grow is thrilled to announce the publication of their new board book, Hello Sometimes. This simple but profound board book helps parents and caregivers support very young children as they make sense of the ongoing effects of the pandemic and the movements for racial and social justice. You can join the organization virtually on July 7th at 7 p.m. and be part of the first ever public reading of the book. You'll hear from the creative team behind Hello Sometimes, as well as educators eager to utilize the book with the children and families they serve. Learn more about this event and how to support the effort at readtogrow.org. Well, thanks for hanging around. A little bit of a thick subject here for a Sunday morning, but nonetheless important. Sarah Isley-Durley is here. She's Assistant Director of the Connecticut Data Collaborative that's partnering with organizations to liberate, analyze, process, and visualize data. And they want to teach you how to do it. Or if you know somebody who works with data in a nonprofit, in the public sector, in the private sector, or otherwise, or somebody who just likes to crunch numbers and data, they want you. ctdata.org is their website. So, Sarah, let's talk a little bit more about the difference between, say, how data analysts who are engaged with this, you know, and it's deep in their DNA, come to the collaborative versus, say, policymakers or individuals who may work in nonprofits.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the main difference is so one of the reasons that we began the Connecticut Data Academy is because we realized providing access to data is not enough. People have to learn how to engage with data in a helpful way. So I would say those are actually two different groups that do use our resources. We have folks who are newer in their data journey, who come to the website, who attend our workshops, who attend our conference, who read our newsletter. And then we have folks who are, like you said, data analysts. There's a ton. We have over 200 data sets on our website that are very easy to use. We make census data available in a much more user-friendly format than actually you can get at the census from the Census Bureau. So it's wow. Connecticut data disaggregated by Connecticut towns, just in a format that's meant for people to create into pivot tables or to use more easily in data projects, data visualization, things like that.
Yeah, so I could see how coming to you guys might be helpful for individuals that might be, you know, producing annual reports, or they might be
Absolutely.
Zeroing in on certain populations or demographics that they serve through a nonprofit, or journalists and newsmakers, media people that want to kind of take a million different ones and O's and make them into a pretty graphic that sums up just a handful of points.
Yes. Yeah, and those are all the different kinds of people that do use the data on our website.
Excellent. So back on June 15th, you guys hosted what was called Connecticut's Equity and Data Community of Practice workshop. And, you know, when I think about data, I think it's kind of neutral and available and important to everyone. So let's talk a little about the E word. How is equity involved?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We do tend to have this idea on the one hand in our culture that, you know, there are these cold, hard facts and data would fall into that side. But on the other hand, we do say, you know, we don't trust data, like darn lies and statistics, you know, that kind of a thing. Mm. So really, when we think about it, when you are working with data, there's kind of this process that you go through. There's planning for data collection. There's actual collecting the data, you know, analyzing the data, and then communicating the data in some way. We generally are looking at data because we want to make some kind of a decision, or we want to inform or lead people to action. So really, humans make decisions at every single point of data. You know, when you think about filling out a survey or filling out a form at the doctor's office, somebody made a decision about what information was important to collect and also how it would be collected, what options are available to you, what options are not available to you. So even at its very beginning stages, when we collect data just as information, people have already made 100 decisions about what to do. And so data, you know, we need to be aware of our own identities, our own perspectives, our own biases, so that we can collect data in a way that doesn't bias the data towards us, so that we anticipate everybody who's entering information or reading this information is like me. So that's why equity is really important. And data also are human. So when we communicate data, we're actually talking about people. Like, somebody is reading the data and seeing themselves in the data. And one of my early experiences with data as a professional was creating this table that I thought was really excellent. I had done all of this work, research about the data, and presented the data to the people that we were looking to support. It was for them. It was supposed to help them. And they felt hurt by what was in the data. I believe that they used that word, actually. They felt that it reinforced stereotypes that people already had about them. Now, if I had just created this table and we had published it as it was, and it was something that was going out nationally to, you know, people all over the country, there would have been a group of people that we were actually trying to support that felt hurt and did not feel supported by what we showed in that data. And so really, when we are trying to support human flourishing, or, you know, supporting human potential of every single person in Connecticut, we have to acknowledge that we have a perspective, our team has a perspective, and to help bring the perspectives of the people in the data into the process, into the data life cycle.
So then, you know, in the last few minutes that we have, let's do just that and try to bring some more people to the table with the Connecticut Data Collaborative. I imagine that this and these monthly meetings or workshops are open to anyone who wants to come to the table.
Absolutely. We love having new people join us. We have a different mix of people every month. So people can go to ctdata.org equity and data resources to see more information about us, how we formed, when we meet, and also a whole bunch of resources that people can turn to when they are trying to integrate these practices into their data work.
Yeah, you guys have a helpline?
We do. If you email us at info@ctdata.org, if you have any data question, we actually take the time to answer your question. If you're looking for a particular data that you can't find, or you found data and you want similar data that's from a different year or a different place, then we actually can, for free, can spend some time helping you find data that you need.
And what's on the drawing board as far as future monthly meetings or subject matter goes?
Well, so some of the topics that we really are hoping to engage with, one topic is how can we help make sure that when we communicate our data, we're talking about how people have strengths that they bring to whatever challenge we're trying to help address, and not just focus on the needs or the deficits of the people that we are analyzing data about. And next month, actually July 20th, we're going to meet to kind of take the next step into our demographic exploration. We talked about how do you collect demographic data in a way that's respectful and helpful. We're actually going to talk about when you have demographic data that's not great, like how do you actually go ahead and use it and make good use of the demographic data that you have, whether it's perfect or not.
Oh, excellent. Well, hopefully folks who are listening who may not feel that they can immediately engage, at least have a great understanding now of what the Connecticut Data Collaborative does, so that if they encounter someone in their workplace, in their volunteerism, or in their community, or in their family for that matter, even younger students, I guess, who may want to apply larger chunks of data or research larger chunks of data for schoolwork that they're doing, they can come to you and learn more. So I really appreciate the conversation this morning. Sarah Isley Durley is the Assistant Director of the Connecticut Data Collaborative. CTData.org is their website. They're leading, convening, and facilitating statewide conferences, forums, and open data calls, as well as these monthly gatherings in bringing data users together to advance a common agenda around data development, access standards, and use. Sarah, great to talk to you, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon. Appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much, John. It was great talking to you.
So this morning we're going to wrap things up talking a little bit about an organization that is devoted to serving Connecticut veterans. I'm talking about the National Veterans Council for Legal Redress, the NVCLR, a Connecticut-based veteran service organization that has been working and impacting veterans' lives since 1982, based and coming out of New Haven to commemorate the Vietnam War. We're talking with the first of two of the co-founders of the organization. Conley Monk is on the line with us, and we'll be talking to his brother shortly. So, Conley, thank you so much for being with us. We know you're a bit under the weather, and we all the more appreciate you taking the time to educate folks that are listening this morning, especially veterans or those who love them who may need your services and aren't aware of your organization. So if we could just start with a little bit of background on how this all came together way back in the early 1980s.
Yes, well, I'm a Marine vet. I served in Vietnam, and after coming home in 1971, I knew that there was a need for a organization fighting in defense of veterans. There was close to 800,000 veterans coming back with bad discharges. The military was discharging them. The war was getting ready, was starting to wind down, and they didn't want to pay a lot of the disability claims, so they got rid of them. So we realized that we had to get involved in this fight. So I organized a group, you know, starting the National Veterans Council for Legal Redress, and we attained legal services for veterans to receive services to help them with their bad discharges, and also to work with all veterans and veterans that needed disability claims upgraded. We got involved in that fight also.
So today, you can say PTSD, and probably 8 or 9 out of 10 people will be able to tell you what that stands for and even a little bit about what it means. But back in the early 80s, I can imagine when people were saying, when discharged veterans were claiming that after they came home, their war experiences were continuing to take a physical and mental and emotional toll on their lives, that if it had happened in any other venue, working in construction or being the victim of some kind of a violent crime, there would have been no question that that person deserved whatever kind of support and assistance, you know, society and human service agencies could provide. But for veterans, I get the impression that, you know, going even way farther back than the early 1980s, a lot of people just saw this as kind of, you know, baked in the cake, part of the job. And, you know, isn't this what y'all signed up for? How back then were you able to kind of crack the case and get the help that these soldiers needed?
Well, let me say that vets that came home with less than honorable discharges was ineligible for that, for any kind of services through the VA or however. But veterans that came home with honorable discharges wasn't entitled to it because it wasn't recognized until 1983. So medically it wasn't recognized. But it's been around for a long time. It used to be called different names, like shell shot, battle fatigue. You know, my father was a World War II vet.
As was
mine. Or the Normandy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Mine was on Okinawa.
Okay. Yeah, I know all about Okinawa.
Yep. So since you've been involved with the organization, what would you cite as one of, if not your greatest accomplishment?
Well, we are responsible for having a monument built in New Haven on Long Wharf, the big Vietnam Veterans Monument. We birthed the idea and we raised $250,000 to have that monument built. Very big accomplishment. Mm-hmm. But also the discharge upgrades, because we got involved with ex-Secretary of Defense Hagel. He wrote a memo that I was classified as one of the poster boy behind PTSD. So he wrote a memo that any vet that could substantiate medically that they had PTSD, that their discharges would be upgraded, you know, to honorable. And that's important because you couldn't receive any medical. You couldn't receive any housing benefits, and it was hard to get a job. So that was also one of our major accomplishments.
Well, before we give you a break and catch up with your brother, Gary, let's let people know out there, especially, you know, the loved ones of veterans who might be in that situation that might be listening, what group of veterans need to initiate the contact with the NVCLR and yourself? Who are the veterans that will most benefit from contacting and working with your organization?
Well, the vets that have less than honorable discharges, they would most definitely benefit, because we still are involved in working with vets to get discharges upgraded. We utilize Yale University, which is the dean of the law school, Mike Wishnick. He helps us, and he allows us to utilize the law students to work with veterans to get their discharges upgraded. Then we also have the Arrearo Center, Cindy Johnson. She's an attorney. She works with us to help get vets discharges upgraded.
Excellent. Well, if people want to learn more, they can go to nationalveteranscouncil.com to begin learning more, not just about the organization, but about how to get help or how to support you guys in your work. The NVCLR is a Connecticut-based referral organization that supports veterans and refers them to agencies that assist them with social, legal, and technical assistance, including help with meals, housing, and benefits. Once again, their co-founder is Conley Monk. We're going to give him a break now and catch up with his brother Gary and find out a little bit more about how this organization is working locally to support vets. So, Conley, thank you so much for your time this morning. Hope you're feeling better, and we're looking forward to talking to you again soon. We're joined now by Gary Monk, the co-founder. And Gary, when I was talking to Conley about how this whole thing got started, you know, involving you, he said, you know, he had been involved in service as a Marine, and you were poised to go into military service. So he thought it was the right time and the right place to sort of bring you along. Is that pretty much the story?
Yes, that is the case. I see my brother is struggling with reentry into the public from the military, and he wanted to start the organization. And at the time, I think I was just finishing up at UConn, and I was interested in going to the military. As he well probably told you, we're from a military family, father, World War II, uncle, World War II, et cetera. So, yes, that is true.
So, when you look at this organization over the scope of time that you've been involved with it, give folks a couple of examples of the impact that NVCLR has had on veterans right here in their neighborhoods in the greater New Haven and in southern Connecticut.
So just going backwards, so to speak, just as recent as the pandemic, we were giving out PPEs and food to veterans as recent as 3 weeks ago on the green, giving them backpacks with blankets, gloves. And then going further back, we just did a partnership with the, in that situation, there was a partnership with Federo and Target Sports out of Cheshire. Mm-hmm. And then prior to that, we did a partnership with the Hill Health Center right there on Columbus Avenue. We gave out PPEs and gift cards up to $50 for veterans to get food goods at Stop and Shop. But again, the PPEs were gloves and masks. We had conversations with them as well as distributing the CDC current information on how to get through the pandemic. And I'll just speak a little quicker. We have some landmark cases that we've done. I don't know if my brother spoke on it or not, but my brother actually is a poster child for PTSD. Mm. He was on Comedy Central even doing a skit with them about PTSD. When he got PTSD, there wasn't a word called PTSD at that time. So when he got out, he suffered like 40, 45 years dealing with PTSD, unmedicated, and then no compensation. But with the Chuck Hagel memo, I believe it was 2012, there was a memo done by former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel.
Yeah, he did mention that.
That. He did?
Okay. Yeah, just the memo itself and what it brought in terms of, benefits and in recognition of these conditions that these vets had that ended up costing them honorable discharge.
Correct. So that was a national impact as well as a local, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my brother also was the lead plaintiff on suing the Veterans Administration for taking too long to fulfill on benefit claims. Mm-hmm. And now veterans can sue the government as a class action lawsuit as a result of that piece of legislation. And also they have changed the paradigm or shift the paradigm in terms of how they deal with veterans getting their claims filled. And so it's a much quicker, much more efficient way to do it. Mm-hmm. So that came right from our organization. And then a visual reminder of who we are, what we're about is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Monument on the Long Wharf here in New Haven.
Right, right.
It's been there since 88. And so we've been really a stand for veterans to get their benefits and so forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you have an available legal partner and someone approaches your organization for a benefit or discharge upgrade for a veteran, is there any cost involved to the individual who's approaching the organization for help?
No, sir, not at all. We don't charge for our services, and basically we are a large referral organization. So we would set them up with one of our legal partners that would be able to do the processing of their discharge upgrade, or if they're going for benefits or more benefits. No charge at all.
So how do folks support your organization if you want to continue the good work that you're doing?
So there's a couple ways. First, I would like to say they can call in and have a conversation with one of our members, or shall I say committee members, for fundraising. And there's a phone number they can call into. It's a 1-800 number. It's 1-877-822-1188. Again, that number is 1-877-822-1188. Now, they can send a check to our P.O. box at NVCLR, that's National Veterans Council for Legal Redress, at P.O. box 9383, that's New Haven, Connecticut, 06533. A website, we're actually updating our website right now, so I don't want them to send it via the website. I'd rather for them to either have a conversation with us or send it via a mail.
Sure.
And when we have the conversation, we can actually give them a cash app. I don't want to put it over the air because I have to make sure to get it correct.
Right, right. Yes. And people can reach out to you and contact you or Conley directly or another representative by using the contact data on the website, which is nationalveteranscouncil.com. We thank you for jumping in, Gary, and picking it up from Conley and wrapping up our program for this morning. Always important coming in Independence Day weekend where, we see a lot of flyovers. We see a lot of veterans out and about. And it's hard to think of the ones that are suffering and are being denied services. But it's great to know that there's an organization like yours out there that can help them with that legal redress, as well as a number of other services. The National Veterans Council for Legal Redress not only provides that legal and technical assistance, including they also provide help with meals, housing, and benefits. Once again, nationalveteranscouncil.com is their website, and we are pleased to talk with Conley and Gary Monk, the brothers who have made this organization possible. So, gentlemen, thank you both for your time this morning. We'll be right back. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.